Okay, I tell you what, I'm just going to say hi to the microphone, and then, yeah, we'll take some questions. All right, so this is Anatomy Truth 31 Hybrid, August 24th. And it's our second class meeting, and I got a question. The pre-lecture reading assignment, or which one? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And the thumb.
Yeah. Okay.
Hold on. So for me, the thumb is the medial, right? And the little one is lateral.
Oh, good question. But in order to describe how to get from one part of the body to the other, we got to put the body in a special position. And what's the special position called? Anatomic position, which is like this. And when you're like this, the thumb is what? Lateral to the little finger. Okay? So you always got to put somebody in anatomic position, right? So even if somebody's like mangled in an accident or something and you're in the middle of surgery and you're telling somebody how to get from one part of the body to the other, right, always think of anatomic position. So that's how you get around in the body. Yeah, medial, lateral. So like this, even if I have my hand like this, which way is my thumb? My thumb really should be lateral, but... Right? It wasn't because I'm contorted. Always put the body and your mind into anatomic position. And then you know how to get around. Right. Okay, so so think of the hierarchical organization of the body. So we start with small things. And after our orientation, what's the smallest thing that we're going to be concerned of in your body? Will be cells. All right? We're going to be concerned with some chemicals. But we don't spend a whole chapter on learning a lot of chemistry in here. We're just going to jump right over chemistry and start talking about cells, which is the next, which is the smallest level that we consider. So a cell is the basic living unit of all life. So if something is going to be alive or not, you got to look and see if it's made out of cells. If it's not made out of cells, then, of course, it can't be alive. Can you give me a name of a particle that kind of acts like it's alive but isn't alive, and but it can be very infectious?
Virus.
A virus, for instance, right? So in order for it to be a cell, it has to have a it has to have a plasma membrane. It's got to have genetic material, and it's got to have cytoplasm, which is the living junk inside the cell. Cytoplasm could be organelles, could be cytosol, and a virus doesn't have cytoplasm, doesn't have a cell membrane. So it's not really a living thing. And therefore, how hard is it to treat a viral infection? Really hard, because you can't kill it, because you can't kill something that's not alive to begin with, right? Okay. So the first organelle, really, that we consider in terms of cells is the plasma membrane, right? And a plasma membrane, right, so here is just a nice view of a cell. Plasma membrane separates the outside world from the inside living world. The outside world is really non-living. And the plasma membrane is real special because it allows things to enter the cell that the cell requires, and it excretes things that are toxic to the cell. So it has some pretty important jobs. And it makes the environment of all this living stuff inside the cell something special compared to the outside world. It's got to keep the pH just right in here. It's got to maintain water and all the nutrients for the cell to live. So our cells that make up a human body contain specialized substructures that we call organelles. Like this one right here, I want you to be able to recognize that one by name. That's a mitochondria. And then I want you to know at least one function of what a mitochondria does. Mitochondria makes energy for your body in the form of a molecule that you should know, and that is ATP. So mitochondria make ATP. We look at that in detail in a physiology class. Some molecules that a mitochondria need to make ATP would be oxygen and glucose, for instance. So without oxygen, mitochondria can't do their job. All right? So this plasma membrane right here actually can be used. The membrane around a mitochondria is very similar. The one way to think about the plasma membrane is that its basic nature is a phospholipid layer. Now, in your mind's eye, how many layers does this kind of look like here? Does it look like one layer, Or could you make up two layers or three layers or what? It actually is, the best way to think of it is two layers. And the basic molecule is a phospholipid. So one of these guys that looks like a head and a couple of legs sticking down, that's a phospholipid. If we put thousands of these molecules together, it forms this membrane. The phosphate group that looks like the head likes to be associated with water. We call that hydrophilic. So it's going to be surrounded by water molecules, but these little narrow tails that are sticking down are actually made out of lipids. And what can you tell me about water and lipid? Do they like to mix with each other or they just automatically separate? They just automatically separate, right? If you have a bottle full of water and you put some oil on the top and you shake it up, it gets all mixed together, but after a little while, what just automatically happens?
Separate.
Automatically separates out, right? So membranes just automatically separate into these pieces. So the basic nature of a membrane, we call it a phospholipid bilayer, just like oil in a bottle with water in it. All right, but furthermore, there's more in this membrane than just a phospholipid bilayer. We see some proteins that span across the membrane, some proteins that are tightly associated to the membrane on the inside. These that go across the membrane we call integral proteins. If we take them out of the membrane, it actually destroys the membrane. So we call that an integral protein. Other proteins that are associated with it but are on the outside, like this one here by itself, and these filamentous proteins, these are what we call peripheral proteins. These can be ripped off of the membrane, but the membrane doesn't get destroyed. The proteins have a number of different functions. Some of them, you see, have a hole through them, but the proper name is a channel. So this is how certain molecules can enter and leave the cell, because a lot of molecules, for instance, including water, can't get through this lipid region of the plasma membrane. So the plasma membrane kind of acts as a saran wrap because of this lipid layer, but if there's a channel, because of this protein, then that molecule can move across the membrane. So other molecules that can move across would be sodium and potassium and glucose and things like that need these proteins to move across the membrane. Other things inside the membrane would be, for instance, this molecule right here in yellow. That's a cholesterol molecule that helps stabilize the membrane, makes it a little bit more rigid, because a membrane, just a phospholipid bilayer by itself, is very fluid. And our membranes probably would just drip on the floor if it wasn't a little bit more solidified by these cholesterol molecules, right? So that just gives some integrity to the membrane. Some proteins that are embedded in the membrane could be enzymes that could catalyze certain reactions. Other proteins could be receptors. Maybe these are proteins waiting to be attached by a signaling molecule that's going to change the metabolism of these cells. A good example of a signaling molecule might be a hormone, for instance, that will change the action of this cell. And other proteins have sugar molecules attached to them, and these act as antigens. All the cells of our body have antigens, right? And notice that it has a particular branching pattern to it. And this branching pattern is specific to an individual. So everybody's going to have a unique branching pattern, different than your brothers and sisters, different than your parents, but somewhat similar. And as you go outside your family, the branching pattern gets what? It gets less similar, right? It gets more dissimilar. So your body knows what cells belong to you because they have all the proper signposts made up these glycolipids. So all the cells have the same signpost on them, or what we call antigens. And if a cell enters your body, if it doesn't have the right antigen, guess what your body does to it? It rejects it, tries to kill it, because it knows it doesn't belong in your body. And so that's the basis of rejection in your immune system. All right, so that's a plasma membrane. The simplest model is what we call the phospholipid bilayer, but a better, more sophisticated understanding of the plasma membrane is what we call the fluid mosaic model. Fluid because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid. These proteins can wander around in the membrane, right? And mosaic, why? Because there are many, many pieces that can be added to the membrane to give it specialized functions. All right, so that's the plasma membrane. All right, let's talk about some of these other organelles right here. Mitochondria, we see, has two membranes. It's got an outer membrane and an inner membrane. The inner membrane forms these folds we call cristae, and it's the association of these two different membranes that makes ATP when oxygen is available. And mitochondria are pretty interesting because they have their own genetic material, and they control their own rate of growth and cell division. So they can duplicate themselves irrespective of mitosis. And I think we talked about mitosis in lab last time. And if you look at this mitochondria, they have the same size and shape as a bacillus. What's a bacillus? It's a bacterium. Yeah, it's a bacterium. It's a rod-shaped bacterium. And this theory is, it's now at the level of a theory. Pretty much all scientists know that this is true, that a mitochondria really is a bacteria that invaded cells like this millions of years ago, and they found a real happy environment inside the cell and just decided to live inside these cells. Right? And so we call this the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. So here are bacteria living in our cells, and we say symbiosis. What does a symbiosis mean? When two organisms come together, they live together, and they both get something from that association, some positive benefit. So what is a positive benefit that this cell gets from this mitochondria? It gets ATP. Wonderful thing. Can't live without the ATP, right? So mitochondria make a lot of ATP. Now, what's the benefit to the mitochondria as it's living inside this cell right here? Well, it's safe, yeah, because it can't get infected by viruses, because the human body's immune system helps protect it from viruses or fungi or other kinds of things that want to predate. But also, it gets some important chemicals that it needs, namely oxygen. Okay, and it gets glucose, right? So it gets energy and oxygen, it's protected. So, you know, it's wonderfully happy right there. So that's why it's a nice symbiosis. Okay. Here is the nucleus. It contains the genetic material. There are chromosomes inside the nucleus. It protects that information because that information defines what your body is and also how it operates. So if that information were to become lost or corrupted, guess what would happen to this cell? It would die. So it's protected behind the nuclear membrane or nuclear envelope. These membranes that surround the nucleus, right, that's called endoplasmic reticulum. We got two kinds. Some of them have a rough surface, kind of looks like sandpaper right here. These little dots are ribosomes, and the job of a ribosome is to finish up protein synthesis. So proteins are built on ribosomes. So the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum, or reticulum that has ribosomes on it, is to make proteins. That's its job. Right? And so for all these organelles, I want you to have like a bullet point idea of what they're doing inside the cell. So if I were to say rough ER, you would say protein synthesis. Mitochondria, you would say ATP synthesis or energy synthesis, right? It makes the energy currency inside the cell. Right? But the other thing with this rough ER, what structural component of rough ER enables it to make a protein? What structural feature of rough endoplasmic reticulum allows it to make a protein? It is this little dot right here. It is the ribosome. So if we rip these ribosomes off, we change the structure of that endoplasmic reticulum. What are we changing just besides the structure? We're changing the function, right? So I want you to appreciate there's always a nice relationship between structure and function. And if you change the structure, what are you changing also? You're changing the function of it, right? So here is endoplasmic reticulum. It's not in nice sheets that bend around the nucleus. These look more like tubes, but they don't have ribosomes on them. So can they make protein?
No.
But they're important synthetic machinery inside the cell. They make lipids or phospholipids. So rough ER is for proteins. Smooth ER is for lipid synthesis. Okay, including phospholipids. And what do you need phospholipids for? Any kind of membrane. The basic nature of any kind of membrane is a phospholipid. So The smooth ER is busy in most cells making phospholipids to make what? All these membranes that you see, including the plasma membrane. Okay. These guys right here kind of look like two barrels that are perpendicular to each other. These are centrioles. They're made out of microtubules. They organize and help the function of microtubules and microfilaments throughout the whole cell. And microfilaments and microtubules form the cytoskeleton of the cell. Some cells are flat. Some cells are columnar. Some are cuboidal, and they're those shapes because the microtubules inside the cell push and pull on the membrane just to give the cell that particular shape. Other kinds of cells in your body are shapeshifters. They can actually crawl around throughout your whole body looking for bacteria like white blood cells. And those are the microtubules and microfilaments inside those cells that are pushing and pulling and causing the cell to change shape. And those are all directed by the centriole right here. Plus, there are other organelles inside the cell, like these vesicles right here, that actually move around inside the cytoplasm. Sometimes they move just by diffusion, but other times they can hop a ride on a microtubule and move from one place of the cell to the other, like from in the cytoplasm to the edge of the cell over here. So microtubules act like a little monorail inside the cell. Have you ever been on a monorail? I don't know if I have been, but I've seen one. Where have I seen one close? Yeah, Disneyland, right? It's just a single rail. You hop on it and you can move around. That's what those microtubules do. They're important for subcellular motility of organelles, and it helps arrange organelles inside the cell to be in specific locations. Okay, other vesicles, let's see, here's a vesicle. It contains lysozyme. And lysozyme is an enzyme that can digest things. So we call that a lysosome. So what's the function of a lysosome? It is to digest things. So it's an intracellular digestive system. Intracellular means inside the cell. So if a bacteria enters the cell, if the cell is smart enough to surround it with this lysosome, guess what happens to the bacteria? Yeah, it dies. It gets digested, and it helps protect the cell. Okay, and that's really important. We've learned some really important lessons with lysosomes because it's surrounded by a membrane, that phospholipid bilayer. And when a cell starts to run out of energy, all these membranes start to break down, and they get leaky. And so what happens to these digestive enzymes inside a lysosome when a cell is running out of energy? They're released into the cell, and what happens to the cell then? It gets digested even before it's dead, and that hastens the death of that particular cell. So when somebody's having a stroke or heart attack, guess what we'd like to give them when those cells start to run out of energy because they're not getting oxygen? We'd like to give them membrane stabilizers to protect these lysosomes. And a good example of a membrane stabilizer would be a cortisone or cortisol. All right, so that's why they're given that, to protect their membrane so that those lysosomes don't run rampant and digest from the inside out. All right, that makes the condition much worse. There are other vesicles inside the cell. I don't see it on here, but it's on here someplace. It doesn't contain lysosome, but it contains an enzyme that breaks down toxic compounds that the cell produces. And that compound is called a peroxidase. So guess what we call those vesicles that make peroxidase? Oh, here it is. It's a peroxisome. So peroxisome is important for detoxification. Lysosome for digestion, peroxisome for detoxification. And then the last kind of vesicle I see that has this product in it, right here, this is what we call a secretory vesicle, because this vesicle can be moved to the plasma membrane, and it can fuse to the plasma membrane, because what's the difference between the membrane of this secretory vesicle and the plasma membrane? What's their basic nature? They're exactly the same. It's a phospholipid bilayer. So they can fuse. They can integrate up with each other. They can add to each other very easily. Maybe you played around with some soap bubbles when you were a little kid, or maybe over the weekend, I'm not sure. Or you had a little wand, stuck it in some soap, and waved it in the air, and it made these soap bubbles kind of fly around. And most of the times when two bubbles touch each other, they bust. But every once in a while, when two bubbles touch each other, what do? They fuse to each other and make even a bigger bubble, right? Because the soap film is the same on both of those bubbles. So the same thing happens with these secretory vesicles. So this is an example of secretion, and when material moves from inside the cell to outside, we call that exocytosis. And guess what that needs? That needs energy for that to happen, because these microtubules have to move these vesicles around. And where do these vesicles get energy from? In the form of ATP, right? So this is a form of what we call active transport. Secretion of active transport. Active means that it requires ATP in order for it to happen. Okay. So where did these particles come from? Well, they're part protein. They came, first off, from the rough endoplasmic reticulum. When rough ER makes a protein, it gets trapped inside the membrane system of the ER. And then it pinches off and forms a little vesicle that moves over to this structure right here, and then it fuses with this structure. And in this structure right here, that protein is modified. Maybe a sugar molecule is added to it, and it becomes a mucopolysaccharide. Muco meaning protein, polysaccharide is part sugar molecule. And the simple name for a mucopolysaccharide is called mucus, like that stuff that comes out of your nose when you have a cold. Okay, and this thing that modifies and packages proteins is a Golgi apparatus. So if you're going to remember one thing about Golgi apparatus, it modifies and packages. But it's also part of the secretory pathway, because all proteins that are made by rough ER end up inside a vesicle and then maybe secreted outside the cell. Okay, so the fate of proteins made by rough ER is for secretion. But we can have other ribosomes, like here's one right here, floating around inside the cytoplasm. Okay, what is this ribosome going to make?
Protein.
It's going to make a protein, but now this protein is not in the endoplasmic reticulum, it is now trapped in the cytosol. So protein can have two different fates. It can stay inside the cell if it's made by a free ribosome, or it could end up being secreted if it's made by the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much all the organelles and some of the key features that you have to know. But I don't want you to lose the big picture. Why do our cells have all of these organelles in them? Some of them have membranes around them, some don't, like the centrioles right here. But why isn't all this stuff just all mixed together? Like in a bacteria. Bacteria doesn't have organelles. It still can be alive. But why do we have organelles inside our cells? What's the advantage of having organelles? Well, we saw that organelles have, what's the difference between, yeah, they have specialized functions, right? Okay, and you can see they have different shapes, which means they have different functions. But the reason why we have different organelles inside our body is for the following reason. I'd like to use an analogy. Think of this building as a cell. Okay, all the exterior walls is like the plasma membrane of a cell. And then when you walk in the building, you could have a building with a whole bunch of different rooms in it, like what this building is made, or it could just be a single room, just one big auditorium. So if it was one big auditorium, okay, we'd be sitting here listening to my lecture, but you'd hear a calculus lecture and a trigonometry lecture and a physics lecture and a organic chemistry, right, and a qualitative analysis chemistry lecture, and what, probably a couple other lectures, all right? So what would that be like? That actually sounds like a really good idea, because you could get a degree in just one semester, right? You just walk in the building and you could take all those notes. But what would really be happening if there was one room? There would be, yeah, chaos. There would be interference, right? Because you wouldn't hear me, you'd hear 20 other lecturers and you couldn't make sense out of it. So what do we do to a building? Put different rooms in there so that special functions can take place in these rooms without interfering with other kinds of functions that are taking place. So that's what these organelles are doing. They're allowing for ATP synthesis, protein synthesis, lipid synthesis, digestion, detoxification, all to happen at the same time, but with what? Without interference, so that the living processes of the cell go on as it's supposed to. All right, so that's something about all of those organelles. Make sure you know some bullet points for all these organelles. Ah, there's a couple we didn't mention, cilia and flagella. It's not on that picture. These are made out of microtubules. Microtubules impart what? Motility. So cilia will sweep. There are surface projections, so they allow stuff to flow over the surface of the cell. We're going to see some cells that have cilia on them that line our trachea. And so our trachea has cilia that are sweeping. Which way do you think they're sweeping, up or down?
Down.
Okay. So if they're sweeping down, they're sweeping all the dust particles that we breathe in into our lungs. But if they're sweeping up, it's sweeping the dust particles out of our lungs, right? So actually up is a little bit better choice. And also those cells are secreting mucus, so that mucus goes up into our mouth. And when all that dust and mucus is in our mouth, what do? No, we just swallow it down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Unless you're a baseball player, then what do? Then you spit it out, right? Okay. Flagella are similar, except they're maybe about 10 times longer. There's one particular cell, human cell, that has a flagellum. Okay, flagellum is singular. Does anybody know the name of that human cell that has a flagellum?
Sperm.
Right? So, again, it imparts motility, but in this particular case, that cell is free swimming. It's not part of an epithelium. It can swim around wherever it wants to. All right, microvilli, it looks like a cilia. It's a little shorter. It's maybe about half the height. And it's not for motility at all. It's for absorption. It helps enhance the surface area of the cell, so it enhances absorption of material. So guess what organs do you think are lined with cells that have microvilli? What's an important cell for absorption? Like your digestive tract, yeah, your intestines, for instance. Yeah, okay. Okay, and nucleoplasm is just all the stuff inside the nuclear envelope. Cytoplasm is just everything inside the plasma membrane. It contains organelles as well as the fluid part of the cell, which is what we call the cytosol. Cytosol is the fluid part. Cytoplasm is cytosol plus all the organelles that are there as well. That's maybe a good way to organize it. All right, the nucleolus is the active part of the nucleus. This is where protein synthesis begins. And we're going to see that protein synthesis has two stages to it. The first part starts in the nucleus. We call that transcription. So transcription is happening in the nucleolus. And chromosomes are what are how the genetic material is stored inside the nucleus. Right, we have 46 chromosomes that make up the human genome. The basic chemical that makes up a chromosome is DNA. And DNA is protected sometimes. It's wrapped up on protein molecules called histones. And when it's wrapped up on a histone, you can see the chromosome, like during mitosis. And it means that chromosome is nice and safe. It's hard to become damaged. But in order for that information to be used, it's got to be pulled off of the histone molecule. Then we call it chromatin. It can be used to start protein synthesis. But if it's a really long, thin filament, guess what? It can break, it can snap, it can get damaged, and that could actually cause the death of the cell when that happens. All right, so condensed chromatin is when you can see a chromosome. Extended chromatin is when it's being used during, for instance, interphase of the cell cycle. We talked about movement of material across the membrane, and the two general processes are either passive transport or active transport. Active requires ATP. A passive transport does not require ATP, but things can only move in one direction. Can only move from high concentration to low concentration as a result of that. For instance, if I open up a perfume bottle right here, even though we don't have a fan blowing the air around, that perfume is going to move. It's going to move from high concentration by the bottle to low concentration. Where's the lowest concentration? Like way in the back of the room over there. So this molecule is going to move from here to the back of the room. But who's going to smell it first? People that are closest, right? You're going to smell it first, then the second row, third row, fourth row. But if we leave that perfume bottle open all night, when we walk in the room, what are we going to smell as soon as we walk in the door? Some of that perfume, because it's going to move all over the room, and the concentration is going to be the same all over the room. If the concentration is the same, will the molecule diffuse anymore? As a matter of fact, you're right, it won't. It needs a concentration gradient. So as soon as the molecule is uniform throughout the whole room, it's going to stop moving. So that's a passive process. We call that diffusion. And osmosis is just when water diffuses down its concentration gradient across a special kind of membrane, like a cell membrane. So osmosis is just a special case of diffusion. Active transport means things can actually move from low concentration to high, but it won't happen automatically. In biology, it requires ATP. In any kind of active process, it requires energy. So for instance, we had that perfume bottle with all that perfume. Somebody took perfume at a low concentration and put it in a bottle with high concentration. What did that require to do that? That took energy to do that. So it's an allowed process, right? Otherwise all that perfume wouldn't have gotten in that bottle, but it just requires energy and some kind of special process to get all those molecules in that small space. The way that your body does it is through vesicles, right? And we looked at exocytosis. That's a way of moving molecules outside the cell. But the reverse process can take place too, namely when a vesicle forms on the cell membrane and some of the extracellular fluid gets sucked into that little dimple, and then that dimple forms a vesicle and breaks away from the cell membrane. That's what we call phagocytosis if there are particles inside the vesicle. But if it's only fluid, we call that pinocytosis. So quite literally, phagocytosis means cell eating, and cell drinking is what we call, oops, pinocytosis. You got a couple pictures in your textbook that show that. All right, I want to tell you just a little bit about protein synthesis. All right, here is that central dogma in biology that says that information flows from DNA. Where do we find DNA? What does it make? DNA makes up your chromosomes. Where do we find chromosomes? During interphase or inside the nucleus, right? So information flows from DNA into RNA, and then the information in RNA is used to make a protein. So how many steps does it take to make a protein from DNA? Two, because I see two arrows right here. Now, what else could you tell me? Is this a two-way street or a one-way street? One-way street, according to the central dogma in biology. All right, so let's talk about this. Protein synthesis is two steps. These two different steps have two different names. The first step right here is what we call transcription. The second step is what we call translation. Does anybody know why we call this first step transcription? You're transcribing. What does that mean to transcribe something? It just makes a copy, like a photocopy of something, right? So it's actually helpful to know what the building block of DNA is. Anybody know what the building block of DNA is? Okay, it's a nucleotide. It's the smallest piece of nucleic acid like DNA. And what about the building block of RNA? Same thing. It's a nucleotide. Okay, modified a little bit, but only slightly. But what's the building block of a protein? Everybody probably knew that before they came to college. The building block of protein is? Amino acid, right? So the building blocks of DNA and RNA are the same, right? So the language of DNA and RNA is the same language. So if you want an exact copy of the DNA, what do? You make a transcript or a photocopy of it. The language is exactly the same. It's a nucleotide language. But going from RNA to protein, what do you have to do? You've got to go from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. The language changes. So what do you call that process when you go from Farsi to Hebrew? That's translation. You go from one language to another. But if you translate it properly, what about the information? Does the information change? No, the information shouldn't change. Only the language changes. So the information that's in this protein is the same that's in RNA, but it changes languages. It goes from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. So hence, we call that translation. Now, you got to know where these take place. Where do you find DNA? Only in the nucleus. It's protected in the nucleus. So this first step, transcription, happens in the nucleus. The second step right here, namely translation, right? This RNA leaves the nucleus, ends up in the cytoplasm, and it's got to match up with a ribosome someplace because that's where protein synthesis takes place, right? So the second step, translation, happens in the cytoplasm someplace, right? So that's what you got to know about protein synthesis. And if you want to know, you know, the three different kinds of RNA that are made, that's nice. Okay, like a ribosome does what? That's the workbench where a protein is made. That's made out of ribosomal RNA. This transfer RNA brings amino acids to a ribosome so that it can be incorporated into a protein. So I like to think of a transfer RNA as like a taxi RNA. And you could probably say that on a test, and I wouldn't take off for it, but don't tell anybody I told you to call it a taxi RNA. But it's just it's a way of taxiing amino acids around in the cytoplasm. And the messenger RNA is really the dictionary that tells the ribosome on how to put amino acids together in just the right way to make the protein that should be made. So when you spell a word, you have different letters of the alphabet, but in order to spell the word properly, those letters have to be in just the right order. You just can't put a bunch of A's and B's together, right, and get the word you want. You have to put A's, B's, C's in the right order to get the word. To get the protein that your cell needs, the amino acids have to be put in the right order when making that protein, and that instruction is carried by the messenger RNA. So they sometimes call that the message, but you could call that the dictionary if you wanted to for a particular protein. Okay. And cell division, guess what? We covered in lab already. Right? So that's pretty much it for cells. Who's got some questions? So you got to know those bullet points for the various organelles, and you should recognize them. Right? I think your textbook has got a couple figures of organelles all by themselves someplace. Right, here we see, for instance, exocytosis. Is that an active or passive process? Uh-oh, I'm almost out of water. Exocytosis is active, requires ATP to move all those membranes around. Okay, what are some organelles? Could you tell? What kind of organelle is this right here? Ruffiar, and this is smoothiar. So what's the function of smoothiar? Yeah, lipid synthesis. Phospholipids would be an example. Oh, there's something else I didn't mention, which will be important a little bit later on in the class, really important in the physiology class. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum is important because sometimes it likes to store calcium ions. And calcium is a very important ion in your body. You know it because calcium is important for bones, to make strong bones. But it has other even more important functions that we'll learn about in this class. And so cells store calcium in smoothiar. What's the job of the nuclear envelope? Protects the DNA so it doesn't get corrupted. Okay, and I can see some ribosomes on it, so these little ribosomes can make proteins even. Okay. All right. This is just a really nice molecular example of a ribosome. It's got a couple different pieces. I'm not so interested in that in this class. Okay, but here is a ribosome attached to endoplasmic reticulum, and when it makes a protein, look where it ends up. It ends up inside the endoplasmic reticulum, so the fate of this protein means that it's going to end up inside this vesicle, which means it can go to the Golgi apparatus for modification, and then it can be repackaged in a vesicle, and it can be used to be secreted to the outside of the cell. So these proteins made by rough endoplasmic reticulum usually end up, what, outside the cell. And maybe it's after being modified by the Golgi apparatus. Or what's another name for Golgi apparatus? It goes by another name. Okay, remember I said I have different names depending on the circumstances, and things in anatomy have different names too, and you just have to know. So Golgi apparatus and Golgi body are exactly the same. So if you see either of those terms on a test, you should just know what the function is. Modifying and packaging, right? And, what's the function of this thing here? modification and packaging because it's the Golgi body. Okay. And then here we see the nice, if I can see the cursor. Does anybody see the cursor? Oh, there it is. Okay. All right. Rough ER, Golgi apparatus, secretory vesicle. So this represents the secretory pathway from proteins that are made by rough endoplasmic reticulum. And here, what's the function of this one? Makes ATP. Here's the outer mitochondrial membrane, the inner one. The inner ones make the Christi membrane, and these are the ones that make ATP, as long as it has oxygen. Oh, let me just tell you a little bit about this before we move on. And tell me if I told you this in lab. How much ATP do you need? And are these important organelles inside your cells? Very important. How much ATP do you need in a day to stay alive? Did I tell you in lab?
No.
No, okay. Well, let's consider that an average textbook-sized person is 70 kilograms. That's a usual figure we publish in textbooks. And, okay, so 70 kilograms is an average size. And if we can weigh the amount of ATP we need to stay alive, it's 40 kilograms. So what's that compared to your whole body size? It's more than half. You need more than half your body weight in ATP just to stay alive every day. It doesn't mean that you have to be carrying around a luggage, a suitcase full of ATP, because as soon as you burn it up to release energy, guess what? Guess who remakes it? The mitochondria. So it gets regenerated all the time in your body. But your mitochondria make about 40 kilograms of ATP every day, which then you use to stay alive. That's a huge amount. All right? Huh? Even when you're sleeping. Yeah, even when you're sleeping, you still use a lot of ATP to run various pumps in your cell membrane, like the sodium-potassium pump. That's the biggest expenditure of ATP. Right? Except if you're running a marathon, then muscle contraction, right, requires a lot of ATP. But there is an organ that requires a lot of ATP because it's controlling all your body, even when you're not thinking, and that is your brain. Your brain requires a tremendous amount of ATP. So another way to think about how important those mitochondria are is to think about when do you lose consciousness when your brain loses oxygen. Because don't forget, these mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. That stops when your brain runs out of oxygen. When do you start running out of sufficient ATP that you can't stay conscious anymore? How long does that take? Does anybody have a feel for that? It's pretty amazing. It's about 3 seconds. All right, so if your heart stops beating, you're going to go unconscious in about 3 seconds because your brain's going to run out of ATP. If you hold your breath, you can maintain consciousness longer than 3 seconds because why? Well, your heart is still beating. It's still delivering some oxygen to your brain. But if your heart stops, 3 seconds, and you become unconscious because your brain is running out of ATP. All right? And if no one is there to do CPR or to get blood recirculated and oxygenate your blood, your brain is going to die because it's going to run out of ATP. How long does it take your brain to die after your heart stops? It's minutes, right? 3 seconds, you'd lose consciousness. And 3 minutes, your brain dies. That's how much ATP is required in your brain, right? Because those mitochondria are regenerating it all the time. So that's what? A really short period of time. That's why CPR is so important, because when somebody's brain dies, what does that mean when somebody's brain is dead? Well, it's never going to come back to life, right? When something's dead, it doesn't come back to life, right? So when somebody does CPR, it delivers enough oxygen so the brain doesn't die, so that if the heart does get started again, right, you have a brain to come back to, right? You can be normal again. But once that brain is dead, it won't ever come back to life again. Okay, so that's the importance and the sensitivity of various organs to ATP. Microtubules, okay, I don't think I'm going to talk too much about those. Oh, well, that was your nucleus, right? Nuclear envelope protects the DNA. And I think that's probably pretty good. I don't talk about DNA synthesis, but here is extended chromatin. And when it's wrapped on these histones, it becomes condensed, and that's what you can see during mitosis, for instance. But during interphase, it's all extended chromatin, and it can be used for transcription to start protein synthesis. Okay. All right, so that's chapter 2. What about chapter 3? Okay, chapter 3, you know, is one of those chapters we're skipping because it's embryology. So that's a little trick question I had for you. Okay. So we're going to move on to chapter 4, which is tissues. So think in your mind of the hierarchical organization of small things being built up to bigger things. What the heck is a tissue? A bunch of cells put together. Exactly right. So we got molecules that we use to build organelles, organelles we use to build cells, and we put a bunch of cells together, we can get a tissue. And one particular tissue means that all the cells are basically the same. They have the same shape. And if they have all the same shape, what does that kind of mean to you? It has the same function. So a tissue is made up of all the same kind of cells that have the same shape, which means it has about the same kind of function. But a tissue actually means a little bit more than that. It also means that not only are the cells the same and have the same kind of shape, but it also means that the material between the cells is similar. We call that the extracellular material. So a tissue has the same kind of cells, the same kind of extracellular material. So all those thousands of cells are performing the same kind of function. And the study of tissues, the structure and function, and you know they go kind of hand in hand, is what we call histology. What do we call the scientific study of just a single cell? That would be cytology. Histology is the study of what? A group of these cells all doing the same kind of thing. All right. The nice thing about histology or the study of tissues is that there are only 4 tissues that make up the whole body, which is really nice and simple. And those are things that cover a surface or line a cavity. That's what we call an epithelium. So epithelium is one kind of tissue. There's another kind of tissue that connects everything together in your body. And we call that connective tissue. It functionally could connect things together, or physically it could connect things together. Right? And then another kind of tissue is specialized for contraction. We call that muscle. And then there's another kind of tissue that's specialized for sending information very rapidly using electrical impulses. And we call that nervous tissue. So those are the 4 kinds of tissues. All right, so let's look at epithelium first. All right, cover surfaces of the body, like your skin. The outermost layer is an epithelium. But it can also line cavities inside your body, like the interior lining of the gastrointestinal tract is an epithelium. And the inside lining of blood vessels, there's an epithelium as well. Epithelium also forms glands, and it has very little extracellular material. So that means that the cells are packed together very tightly in an epithelium. There's no space between them whatsoever. And the really strange thing about epithelium is because they're packed so closely together, they don't have blood vessels in them. All right, so an epithelium never has a blood vessel. That's a really strange kind of characteristic. All right, so let's look at, we have to go to a little bit different chapter. Come on, cursor. All right, so I guess I have to close this. And I have to go to here. Okay, so this is kind of a nice way to view an epithelium first. An epithelium are just these cells right here. All right, and then this is underneath the epithelium. So the kind of tissue that we see deep to an epithelium is always going to be a connective tissue. And connective tissue has nerves and it has blood vessels, but do you see this blood vessel ever going up into this epithelium right here? It's never there. Okay. So an epithelium has got this free space. This could be the inside of a blood vessel, could be the inside of a digestive tract, or could be outside your body. There's nothing there. There's just free space. Right? So this is what we call the apical surface of an epithelium. On the opposite end of these cells, we call this the basal surface, basilar surface or basal surface or basal region. This is the region that's connected to the connective tissue down over here. All right, so an epithelium's got an apical region and a basal region. And these cells can be connected to each other by specialized little organelles, like this one here is a gap junction. This allows for electrical currents to pass through it, a form of communication. There can be desmosomes and adherence junctions, which means that these anchor the neighboring cells together very, very tightly, right? Which explains why we have very little extracellular space. There could be another kind of junction, like a tight junction right here, right? And these are just special little like globs of glue that glue the plasma membranes together so that material can't slip between the cells and go from the apical surface down through the basal surface and get inside the body. So if material goes through across the epithelium, it's got to be what we call transmembrane transport. It actually has to go through the cell. It can't go between the cells because of those tight junctions right there. And here we see some epithelia have cilia on them. Some have microvilli. What's the function of microvilli?
Absorption.
It increases surface area. Cilia would be for motility, for sweeping things. All right, so I want you to know apical surface versus basal surface. And right underneath the basal end of this epithelium is what we call the basement membrane. And the basement membrane should be nice and smooth and continuous. It shouldn't be jagged. We shouldn't see cells poking through it, because that's a sign of something terribly going wrong with the epithelium, like maybe a carcinoma, cancer or something, breaking away from the epithelium and metastasizing to other parts of the body. All right, so the way that we talk about epithelium is by, all right, the kinds of layers that they're made up of. All right, looking at the, I'm going to have to move over to the other cursor. Or maybe I can just move this one down. Let's see. Okay. Here we see the basement membrane. Here's the basal surface. Here's the apical surface. How many layers of cells do you see?
One.
So we call that a simple epithelium. The other example, going from the basal surface to the apical surface, how many layers do you see? And in this particular case, you would say many. All right, so we're just going to break it down into one versus many. And if it's one, it's simple. If it's many, it is stratified. And it doesn't matter how many there are. Right? There could be 50, there could be 3 or 2, but in any case, it would be stratified if it's more than one. All right, another way that we characterize epithelium is by the shape of the cells. We've got three main ways, or three main shapes, and then there's an oddball kind of shape. Here are some flat cells. Anything that's flat, we call squamous in our body. So certain regions of bones will be flat. Guess what we call that region of a bone, like the temporal bone? That's going to be the squamous region of the temporal bone because it's flat. It makes the side of our cranium. Other cells are going to be really square. We call that cuboidal. And some cells will be kind of cuboidal, except they're really tall compared to their width. So those are what we call columnar. So when we characterize an epithelium, we got to say the number of layers and the cell shape. And that completely characterizes that epithelium for us. All right, so here we have, now here, the cells kind of look maybe a little bit cuboidal down by the basal region, but the apical region, what do these cells look like? They look squamous. So we characterize or classify this epithelium by the shape of the cells in the apical region, not the basal region. So what kind of epithelium would this be? By shape and by layers, it would be stratified and squamous epithelium. This would be a simple squamous epithelium. Right? So that's pretty easy to see. All right, so let's look at some epithelia here. So these are things that you will actually get on your practicum. All right, so we're going to look at some of these things underneath the microscope, but it's too difficult to set up a practicum with a pointer that moves around, so I'm just going to have out slides from your textbook or slides that are really, really similar to your textbook for the practicum. And I want you to tell me if this is nervous tissue, muscle tissue, connective tissue, or epithelium. Okay, and then in particular, what kind of epithelium it is, if it is epithelium. All right. Well, what are we looking at right here? I see, what should your eye automatically key to answer some of these questions? For an epithelium, I want to see a nice basement membrane that's nice and continuous, well formed, which I see right here. And then I see an apical surface with a free area, with nothing in it right here. Right? So this is an epithelium. And how many layers going from the basement membrane to this apical surface do we see? How many cells do we see?
One.
So what would we characterize that as? Simple epithelium. But now what about the shape of these cells? You also need to see that. What are these, squamous or columnar or cuboidal? These are cuboidal. So the way we talk about this is that it is just a simple cuboidal epithelium. And it's used to make a tube in the body. And this part of the tube, which is carrying the product to one place or another, that's what we call the lumen of the tube. And a blood vessel that's carrying blood, the inner part of a blood vessel, that's called the lumen of the blood vessel. And your digestive tract, which is a tube that's carrying digesting material through it, the inner part that's carrying that material is called the lumen of your digestive tract, right? So that part of the tube that's carrying something is called the lumen, all right? And then deep to the epithelium right here is always going to be connective tissue of some kind, right? I'm not going to ask you to tell me what kind of connective tissue it is, but it's just labeled connective tissue. So the slides on the practicum will be almost these exact same slides, but actually the ones that are in your study guide for the test. There's a couple pictures that are just a little bit different than are in the more recent edition of the textbook, but you should be able to see them without any problem. And these lead lines, right? I might ask you those on the practicum. This will be question number one. What are these pointing to? That's a simple cuboidal epithelium. And what is this line pointing to? Basement membrane, right? And this is pointing to connective tissue. So here are three possible questions I could ask you on the practicum from this picture in the book, right? So, and I think you all have the book, but if you don't have the book, it's in the reserve section of the library. You can go practice those as many times as you want. Plus, you got the study guide, right? You can print those pictures out, at least in black and white. But on the practicum, what I did is I just took these JPEGs and I emailed them to Sam's Club and they printed them out for me. Okay, so your pictures on the practicum will be in color. Because I know some of you guys like color, right? Okay. All right, so simple cuboidal. Next picture we got right here. Look at this nice basement membrane right here. I see a free edge with nothing in it. So this has to be an epithelium of some kind. How would you classify this one? How many cells do you see? One, so it's simple, and the shape is columnar. So here's a simple columnar epithelium. And this, I maybe see some microvilli right here. So these are specialized for absorption, like what we would find in the digestive tract. All right, so microvilli are extremely hard to see with a light microscope because they're so small and thin. And they're usually surrounded by mucus, and so you get just the slightest impression that you can see them with a real micrograph. Okay, as opposed to these guys here. Much easier to see, right? Cilia are bigger, they're thicker, they got more structures associated with them. So this epithelium, right, here's a basement membrane. I like the previous edition a little bit better. All right, these cells kind of look columnar up by the apical edge right here, but if you look, in some regions, it might be just one cell going all the way from the basement membrane to the apical surface. In other regions, it looks like maybe there's two or three cells. So this is what we call pseudostratified. Nobody can make up their mind whether it's stratified or not, but it mostly is more stratified than that, so we call it pseudostratified. And it is, what, ciliated, and it's columnar, and it's an epithelium. So sometimes we call this kind of epithelium, and usually more times than not, we call it PSCC, standing for pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, PSCC. Where we find that kind is in the airways, like the trachea, and don't forget those cilia are sweeping up all the time, getting rid of garbage so our lungs don't fill up with stuff. Okay, and whenever you give me an answer on a practicum, make sure you tell me if it's an epithelium or a connective tissue or a what? Muscle. And what's the fourth kind of tissue? Yeah, nervous tissue, right? So just don't say pseudostratified ciliated columnar, because you also should tell me that it's what? Because I might get confused. I might say, well, is that muscle? You're going to say what? Epithelium, right? And you can abbreviate epithelium EPI, so you don't have to write epithelium out every single time. Okay. All right. Now, here's another kind of epithelium. How do you know this is epithelium? Let's review some characteristics of epithelium. You see any blood vessels in here? No. That's a nice characteristic. What about spaces between the cells? No spaces between the cells whatsoever. So that really says that it's an epithelium. Here's the nice basement membrane. What do you have deep to the basement membrane? You have connective tissue. All right, and then how many cells do you see going from the basilar region up to the apical region right here? You see many. Okay, and then the shape of these cells in the basal, I mean in the apical region are squamous. So how would you describe this epithelium to somebody properly? Stratified squamous epithelium. Exactly right. And you looked at some of these cells last week in lab. These are the buccal cells that line your cheek. Right, so they slough off all the time, and that's really what a stratified squamous epithelium is designed to do. It's designed to break away from your body, but that's okay because these cells down over here replace the ones that fall off. It's designed for abrasion, to be on surfaces that are abraded, like what? Your skin, because your clothes are rubbing off skin cells all the time. Every time you swallow a couple 100,000 skin cells from the inside of your mouth, but that epithelium is designed to do that, right? It's replaced by the cells that are deep to it. All right, here is, now what would you want to say, muscle or epithelium or nervous tissue or what right here? Even though we haven't looked at all those other tissues, I see what? A nice smooth basement membrane. I see this space right here, so here is a free surface. So this is the lumen of some kind of tube. And going from basement membrane to the apical surface, how many cell layers do I see? I see two. So what would you classify that as? Would you say simple? Can't. Right? So you'd say stratified, and the shape is? As cuboidal. So it's a stratified cuboidal epithelium. Okay? So are you being, can you see what I'm talking about? I think you guys can see what's going on. We'll practice these a lot in lab on Wednesday. Okay, to get it down. Okay, here's an interesting cell tissue. Here is the basement membrane right here. And these cells kind of look, by shape, columnar. And we can see that it's a couple layers. So this is stratified columnar epithelium, like in our urethra. Right here, stratified columnar. And this is an odd kind of epithelium. All right, so most epithelium we can classify as either being squamous, which means flat, cuboidal, or columnar. But here's one that's a shapeshifter. So we don't characterize this one as being squamous or cuboidal or columnar. It changes shape, right, because it's lining an organ that changes its shape a lot, namely the urinary bladder. Okay? So as the urinary bladder fills up with urine from these kidneys right here, guess what happens to it? It stretches out. Okay? And then when the urinary bladder is voided, it goes back to its original shape. And so these cells have to change shape. When the bladder is voided, they kind of look like pillows. and it has many different layers right there. I can't say squamous. These aren't, really don't look like squamous cells. They don't look like cuboidal cells. They don't look columnar. We call this a transitional epithelium. And as the bladder fills up with urine, they become very squamous in nature. They stretch out and become flat, right? So they change their shape from squamous to these pillow-shaped ones depending on the state of the urinary bladder. So we call that transitional epithelium. Nonetheless, what do we see? Nice basement membrane right here. And deep to that is connective tissue, maybe some smooth muscle. And then here is the free edge, the apical surface, right? So this would be urine up in this area right here. Yeah?
Are we going to ask this to only identify the tissue based on the photo or the slide, or can you also ask us what kind of tissue we find in the bladder?
Oh, you know what? I'm not going to ask you by organ. And I won't show you a tissue and ask you the organ that it comes from. It's a little bit much in the first week or two of class. Okay, and I think eventually you'll have a pretty good feel for that maybe by the time the class is over, but I won't ask you that on the first practicum or the first test, I don't believe. Okay? Okay. So I know you guys are just sort of getting your feet on the ground. All right, so let's look at this. This is an epithelium that lines a blood vessel. Could you classify this epithelium for me by shape and by layers? Okay, well, I see a lot of layers right here, but this would be the basal surface right here, and then the apical surface is this rim. So here's the basal surface, here's the apical surface. How many cells do you see across this region right here? That's one. So this really is a simple, right? But they're just all lined up together. So it almost looks stratified, but it's from here to here that you want to count the cells, not from here to down over here. So it's a simple, and what did the cells, what's the shape look like? Squamous. So a simple squamous epithelium lines all blood vessels, but not only that, but it lines every surface inside the heart too. And since it's lining the inside of a blood vessel, we call it an endothelium instead of an epithelium. All right? But it's really just kind of a little twist of terminology. Okay. Okay, so we look at all these different kinds of epithelium. Don't forget that epithelium can also make glands. And there are a couple different kinds of glands. Two major kinds of glands. We've got exocrine and endocrine glands. All right, an endocrine gland is a gland that makes a product, could be a lipid, could be a protein, and then it's secreted from the cell, maybe by exocytosis with a vesicle, and that particular compound gets absorbed by the blood, by a capillary, and once it's in the blood, where does it go? Where does that product from an endocrine gland go once it gets in the blood? It goes everywhere that blood goes, right? So, which means what? Almost everywhere in the body. So, an endocrine secretes a product that goes everywhere in the body, and we call, what do we call a product of an endocrine gland? Because it gets transported by the blood everywhere in the body. We call it a hormone, right? So, an endocrine gland always secretes a hormone, but it gets transported by the blood. An exocrine gland, on the other hand, where's exocrine gland? Right here. It secretes a product, but it doesn't secrete something into the blood. It has a special duct that carries it to a part of the body where it's going to function. Like you have sweat glands in your body. Those are exocrine glands because that sweat doesn't end up in your blood. Where does it end up? It ends up on the surface of your skin, cooling your body down, right? So that's an exocrine gland. The pancreas also has an exocrine part to it. It makes digestive enzymes. Now, is it a good idea for those digestive enzymes to be released inside the pancreas? What would happen to the pancreas if those digestive enzymes get secreted into the pancreas? The pancreas would be digested away. So instead, the pancreas secretes those digestive enzymes into a duct, and that duct carries those enzymes to the small intestine where they can digest food in the proper location, right? And if the pancreas ever starts to digest itself, can you imagine what that would be like? It would be horrible. It's really difficult. And it happens during what we call pancreatitis, and it also happens during pancreatic cancer. And you can imagine what it's like to treat somebody either of those two pathologies. It's almost impossible, right? Because that organ just digests itself from the inside out as a result of that, right? Really difficult conditions to treat. All right, so that's the exocrine part of the pancreas. And you should probably know some glands by their particular shape. So these glands right here, would you call these exocrine glands or endocrine glands? Remember, exocrine has a duct, endocrine has no duct. Do you see ducts or no ducts? I see ducts. So all of these are examples of exocrine glands. Okay, if that duct forms just a simple tube, we call that a simple tubular gland. But if it has branches coming off, we call it a simple branch tubular gland. And then if it has branches upon branches, like what we see over here, we call that a compound tubular gland. But another kind of gland might be more like a berry. It might be more spherical. So we don't call that a tube gland. We call that an alveolar gland because it has the shape of an alveolus. An alveolus is what? Like a little berry or something. We're going to run into alveoli, for instance, in the lung. And guess what kind of shape that means?
Round,
right? So here's a simple alveolar gland. Here's a simple branched alveolar gland. And then here is a compound alveolar where there are branches upon branches, but nonetheless, these are all what? Spherically shaped or round-shaped glands. And then this last kind over here is a combination of a compound tubular and compound alveolar because we actually see both kinds of glands in there, right? And so this would be a compound tubulo-alveolar. So what the heck does that mean? That just reinforces terminology. We can take two different terms, disparate terms in anatomy, but put them together if it makes sense as long as we do what between these two terms? We put an O between them, right? Like tubulo-alveolar. It has characteristics of being a straight tube, characteristics of being a spherical thing, and we put them together, tubulo-alveolar. Right? So that's some nomenclature that we have to use. And could you give me an example of two cavities that we could put together and put an O between them? Abdominopelvic cavity. Right? Put an O between them. That's the same thing as the peritoneal cavity, right? Okay. When are we done in here? I guess we go to 4:30. I guess we're done for today because it's 4:20. So what we didn't look at, which we'll look at in lab next time, will be connective tissues. And I didn't take roll call today. So I'll sign you guys in on Wednesday. Remind me to take roll call on Wednesday. I'll do better with that as time goes on. All right. So did anybody listen to the lectures online? Not yet. They're there? Okay. And this one I'll put up there maybe toward the end of the week. So give it a try. And if it's not helpful, I'll stop doing it. But if it's helpful, I'll be happy to keep putting them up there.